Restaurant Unstoppable, episode 21.
Welcome to RestaurantUnstoppable.com. Listen to successful restaurant professionals as they discuss the tools, tactics, and services they use to better lead, manage, and market their restaurants. Join our community and make your restaurant dreams unstoppable. Here's your host, Eric Cacciatore.
Yo, what's going on, all you unstoppable restaurant professionals? It's your host, Eric Cacciatore. I have a great show today. It's going to be a long one. I have to give credit to my guest. He was filled with valuable content, and he holds the record for longest episode. We went over an hour today, so just a little heads up, you might want to break this one into two parts, but it's totally worth listening to. Everything our guest says is valuable and worth absorbing. If there's anything we talk about on the show you want to check out, some books, don't forget to check out the show notes, www.restaurantunstoppable.com. All the notes are right there. Don't forget to connect with me, LinkedIn, Google+, Facebook, Twitter. I'm out there. I'm easy to find, and I'm waiting for your engagement. So reach out. Let me know who you want to hear from, and I'll do everything and anything I can to connect with that individual. I hope you enjoy today's show. Here it is. All right. With excitement, allow me to introduce to you today's guest, Chris Coombs. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you for being on the show. I can't wait to listen to what you have to share with us. So a quick background on Chris. Chris is a graduate from the Culinary Institute of America in New York. In 2006, Chris joined forces with Brian Pacini. Am I saying that right?
Pacini.
Sorry, Brian. I didn't mean to butcher your name if you're listening. And they started Boston Urban Hospitality, Inc., with focuses on fresh, local, and seasonally inspired menus. Today, Boston Urban Hospitality, Inc. consists of D-Bar, Duwave, and Boston Chops. Chris has been featured on Food Network's Chopped and Forbes 30 Under 30. Now that I've given a quick background, do you want to elaborate and tell us a little bit more about your history in this industry?
Sure. So I actually, interestingly enough, I got started at a very, very young age, as I feel like is sort of been the trend with many great chefs these days, is, getting in the kitchen at a getting the early start. And my early start began in a neighbor's seafood restaurant at around 11 or 12 years old. And, in a lot of families, people begin working, around 16, 17, mm-hmm. or when they're in college, 18, 19. But in my family, you started working as soon as you were able. And, yeah. My family, we grew up, we didn't have a heck of a lot. So as soon as I was able to do anything productive, that was the way it was. So I began washing dishes and doing medial prep tasks and, cleaning grease traps and floors and sweeping and mopping and things like that. At the young age of, around 11 at this really fancy restaurant called Ocean Delight. And that was on Lynn Street in Peabody, Massachusetts.
Okay.
And it really wasn't that fancy. It was more like, it was basically a fish fry place, a North Shore fish fry place.
All right.
But, pardon me?
I said, all right. Yeah. I'm just listening.
Yeah. So it was basically, it was a way for me to get, $5 an hour. Mm-hmm. And at the time that was enough to, support my habit for, baseball cards and Nike Airs instead of Payless shoes. So that was how I got started. And initially, it was just for the money. But
yeah.
As I grew older, it was something that I really started to enjoy. Especially once it was less about cleaning grease traps and more about when I began shucking clams or oysters, mm-hmm. or making mashed potatoes actual cooking.
Yeah.
So the actual cooking probably didn't start until about, 13 or 14 years old, where I was effectively working like a fryer waiter and a a broiler station.
Let's fast forward to you graduated to from the Culinary Institute of America, and you had the privilege of working with some pretty awesome people. Who are some of those people?
Sure. So if we're fast forwarding to the college time, I had the honor to work with Ming Cai Blue Ginger for my internship during his beard winning year of 2002-2003. Mm-hmm. And that was really, honestly, that was just having a good steering committee and good mentors being like, hey, you have to go work for this guy out in the western suburbs. And that really wrote my ticket. Mm-hmm. As far as, you know, where I went and who I worked for next. So following that, I went to Toppers at the Wawinet out on Nantucket, Relay Chateau property, just for the summer. And following that, I went to the Inn at Little Washington in Washington, Virginia for Chef Patrick O'Connell. And spent just under a couple of years down there, and then moved back up to Boston to work at Oujoudoui, the now closed Oujoudoui, and then Troquet, and then I was on to Boston Urban Hospitality with Brian.
Awesome. So yeah, that's quite the track record, and it's so important to have the mentors like you had in this industry to kind of shape and mold and show you the way. And I'm sure you're very grateful to have those mentors. And one thing I wanted to point out too is that you started at that young age, so it's great when you start young and you there's no secret. You're cleaning those grease traps, like you said, and it's to get that exposure at a young age and to know what you're in store for. It goes a long way with helping make that decision when you're in your adulthood. So that's all cool stuff. One thing I like to ask my guests before we get started into the real nitty gritty is, are you ready to make some restaurant dreams unstoppable?
Absolutely.
You're going to be great. I can't wait. So share with us a success in a leadership quote or mantra that you like to apply in your life or at your restaurants.
Right. So, you know, for me, I came up in a very different restaurant time than what the current world is now. I think, you know, in a lot of industries, a lot of professions, timing is everything. And my personal career so far has been right place, right time, quite a few times in a row. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've evolved as a manager and now with 130 employees, you know, ultimately I really truly believe in treating people well, paying them well, and retaining them. And ultimately, this business is just ridden with turnover. And a lot of the first kitchens I worked in, it was just, I mean, the level of abuse and treatment. I mean, you were just treated like shit all the time. And don't get me wrong, that built me into who I am today. But a lot of learning happens when you recognize the ways that you don't want to run your restaurant, you know. And I try and lead a positive example at all times, but I've also learned a lot from knowing the way that I wouldn't want to do things. You know, so there's as much to be learned in great restaurants about how you would do things when you have your own place as there is how you would not do things. And I think that keeping both those things into perspective sort of paves your own way through this business.
Absolutely. That's kind of been a reoccurring topic on this show. You don't always have the best people to work for, but every experience you have in this industry is a learning opportunity. It's a way to learn how you want to be when you're at that level where you have your own employees and who you want, like, you know, who you want to model yourself after and who you don't want to model yourself after. So
I'd like to tell you a quick story that's just an example, and I've actually never told the story publicly.
Oh, please do share it with us.
There's a couple people who are aware of it, but so my first job out of culinary school, as I said, was out of Toppers at the Wawinet, and there was a Finnish sous chef there named Henry, and he was an older gentleman at the time. I think he was mid-40s or something like that. I'd been cooking for, you know, 20 years, and he was just an old, bitter prick. And ultimately, you know, I was a punk-ass young kid who just, you know, I was a ball of fire at the time. But, you know, I had some habits that he may not have particularly cared for. And one of those habits was I always used, in the past, I used to put my side towel down. which when you're cooking, you know, you should keep your side towel nicely folded. And when you're using both hands, you put that underneath your arm. So you basically pin your side towel between your arm and your ribcage. Mm-hmm. But I used to put my towel down everywhere, and it used to drive Chef Henry crazy. So he would start throwing my side towel everywhere in the kitchen. I only had two, you know, whether it was under the refrigeration, in the middle of service, to teach me to keep that thing on my body at all times, which was a good lesson learned. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for whatever reason, it's very difficult for me to break that habit and keep that towel attached to my body at all times. So he got tired of throwing the towel everywhere because it would slow down the pickups. So he started this new practice, which was to put a coon spoon on the flat top and heat it up. And every time I put my towel down, he'd put the coon spoon on the flat top, heat the spoon up, and he'd lightly touch it to the side or back of my neck, which sucked. But it was a hot kitchen. I was always sweating, so it'd make more of a sizzle, and it, you know, you'd hear like a sizzle near your ear, and that would sort of scare you. Now that wasn't a very pleasant learning experience for me. But what was even less pleasant was the time that he heated it a little bit too much, and I turned into it, and I got myself a nice second degree blister on my neck in the middle of service. I was like sweating. I almost passed out from it because it's like, you know, when you get a burn on, you know, there's a lot of nerves in your neck and stuff like that. So. You know, and honestly, I mean, at the time, you know, this is 2003, 2004, somewhere in that time frame. Mm-hmm. You know, the stories of pans being thrown at people and plates and this, that, and everything, you know, it all seemed like very, very standard stuff. But I'm so happy to see how far our business has come that those things, you know, those things don't occur on a regular basis anymore. And that type of behavior just doesn't. It's not acceptable in restaurants any longer. But that was a learning experience where I was like, okay, I will never physically abuse any of my employees because ultimately, like, I still have a scar on my neck from the tip of the spoon burning my neck, you know, 10 years later. So
here's my question: do you still keep that side towel on you at all times, or do you?
Oh, I never put my side towel. And you know what? It's a really interesting learning tool now because I'm able to teach young cooks to keep their side towel, you know, pinned under their arm with a lot more effective methods than burning them or throwing this. You know, there's other ways to teach people, but oftentimes, you know, if someone really is just leaving, you know, mm-hmm. crumbled up towels everywhere, which is pretty gross. That's a great story to tell them to be like, hey, here's how I learned. So why don't we figure this out a more diplomatic way? And then, really, chef?
Here are your options. Either I can burn you or we can do it this way.
Oh, no, I'd never burn anyone. Sure.
Well, thank you for sharing that story. It was entertaining and, it's kind of good way to show how far our industry has come, and we want to be treated like professionals in this industry, but in order to kind of adopt that professional image, we need to start acting like professionals, and we have made some progress, which is great. Thank you for sharing that. The next question I have for you is, let's talk about your it factor. What are the personal qualities that you possess which contribute to your success in this industry?
Look, at the end of the day, there's a lot of really, really talented chefs out there, and we live in such an exciting era. And I think one of the things that, you know, one of the things that really makes Chris Coombs is that I've always been willing to work longer and harder than everyone else around. And when I say that, I mean still, even with the three restaurants, I'm working 90-plus hours a week, and this is my whole life. Well, you know, luckily I have my wife by my side, but I, you know, I'm all in all the time.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's, I think part of the tricks, and it's going to come back to passion is, it's work. There's no doubt that it's work, but if you're passionate about it and it's your life, then it feels less like work. And I think that's probably one of the characteristics that is, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but would you agree to that?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you did mention earlier that, you say that you've right time, right place, right time. But sometimes, you know, when you're a hard worker and people see this about you and, you treat people well and you say that you believe in treating people well, it seems like right place, right time, but really what's going on is, you're putting those positive energies, those positive thoughts and, it all comes back to pay you positively, and opportunities occur when you work hard and you treat other people well. So I'm sure that had something to do with it too, which is another factor about you. You could disagree with me if you want, but I don't think you would you say that probably has an impact on your success today?
Certainly.
Yeah, I would believe so. So the next question I have for you, Chris, is your favorite restaurant experience. We have so many incredible stories working in this industry. Many of these stories are lessons, or lifelong lessons, and reminders to why we are in this industry and why we show up to work every day. So can you share one of these stories with us?
Sure. So back when I was at the Inn at Little Washington, there were so many lessons learned in such a looking back such a short period of time, because I was just surrounded by so many amazing people who shared such a wealth of knowledge with me. And I think one of the things that really has formed my cuisine today is I distinctively remember having great relationships with local foragers and farmers back 2004, 2005. And look, you know, today it seems like every chef, especially, you know, in the Boston metro area, they're all, you know, their business plan is, you know, local, seasonal ingredients, small farms. But it's like we're all doing that now. That is the standard. You know, that's the way it should be.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that I learned, you know, and it sort of happened by accident was, you know, I used to handle a lot of the foragers and things like that would show up to the back door. And one of the service captains at the Inn at Little Washington, William Washington, used to exclusively forage mushrooms to sell to the Inn at Little Washington. And at the time, I lived on a 300-acre ranch in Virginia. I was actually, believe it or not, in my spare time, I was a live-in personal trainer for a very wealthy family. So we had a ton of land, and when I saw William come in with all these mushrooms and make money, I thought that was very interesting. So I started foraging the land around my house, and I used to bring, you know, every other day a 5-pound bag of mixed mushrooms.
Oh, wow.
That most of them were poisonous. I mean, most of them you couldn't eat. And it used to drive this guy, William, crazy. And I'd be like, oh, did I get anything edible? We'd go through each mushroom one by one. You know, he'd explain what they were and how to identify them. And I, you know, I begged him. I was like, please, you know, take me out foraging with you. You know, please show me, like, what you're doing. Because, you know, up in the Shenandoah Valley there, it is such a fertile area. I mean, mushrooms of, you know, of the hundreds are everywhere. I mean, just tons and tons of different kinds. So needless to say, after bringing, you know, junk mushrooms to William every, you know, other day for 3 or 4 months straight, I bought in a bag of what? Were actually seps, or porcini mushrooms. And that was sometime near the summer. And when I brought those in, then he was like, okay, now this is exciting. Like, will you take me out on your land so we can forage together? And I was like, okay, well, there's a bunch of these mushrooms on my land where I live, but ultimately you're going to have to take me out other places and show me how to forage. So William and I became very good friends. And he really showed me a lot about foraging. And it took me a couple of years before I was really confident enough to do it on my own. But ultimately now the foraging and gathering is something that's really become a part of my cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, locally in the spring, I'll go out and get, you know, oxalis, miner's lettuce. I got nettles this past weekend, ramps. Morels aren't quite in yet, but you know, yeah. there's tons of local you know, cress and things like that that I'll gather, and then, you know, through the summer there's tons of mushrooms. In the fall we get our big mushrooms, like the you know, hen of the woods and chicken mushrooms and things like that. So it's really become another dimension of cuisine, which is you know, gathering what's given to us from the earth locally. And, you know, the constant expansion of, you know, learning about new edibles is very, you know, honestly, it was something that it takes you years and years and years and years and years in the field of identifying these things because it's as the saying goes, you know, there's a lot of good mushroom foragers and there's a lot of old mushroom foragers, but there sure isn't a lot of good old mushroom foragers, you know. And, you know, Noma really came out and made this gathering thing hip. So, again, just being a little ahead of the curve with being able to walk in the woods and find things that are delicious and choice edibles is... Yeah. A skill that certainly, you know, now I've been able to pass that on because I'm not always able to, you know, gather everything myself. But I've got a team that I go with now, and that's a really interesting part of the cuisine over at Uav.
Awesome. Well, that was a great story. You know, if I could point out, like, one key lesson or takeaway you may have had from this story, and this is just from listening, it seems like if I could take a lesson away from this, it's that this gentleman, when you first met him, it seems like you were very persistent, and you just kept trying and trying and trying, and you wouldn't quit to get his attention to take you out. And would you say that maybe could have been one of your key life lessons is, you know, if you really want to do something and you really want to get what you want, you have to be persistent?
Absolutely. Yeah. I would agree with that 100%.
Awesome. Okay, the next question I have for you is on the topic of enlightened hospitality. And for those of you who don't quite understand what we mean by enlightened hospitality, it's defined as prioritizing your the order in which you're hospitable, starting with your inner guests or your employees, then your guests, then your community, then your suppliers and your investors. Can you think of a story where you witness one of either yourself or one of your team members displaying enlightened hospitality?
Look, I think to display an example is rather vague. I think that enlightened hospitality it really is more of a way of life. Mm-hmm. And when I say way of life, I mean a way of work, especially at Duav, because that's the attitude in which we approach every guest every day to try and provide the most memorable experience from the entrance of the building to the time they leave. So to, you know, ultimately it becomes a function of team because, you know, if all the way from the dishwasher to the hostess to the general manager to the sommelier to the cooks, it really is a team effort to have that experience prevail, because if one person is off or one person's mm-hmm. not sharp or one person doesn't have that enlightened hospitality mentality in mind at all times, that's when the guest, the indoor service suffers. And oftentimes we strive for perfection and it may not be attainable, but it's something that we certainly strive for on a daily basis as a team.
So you say enlightened hospitality is a way of life and a way to live. What words come to mind when you think of hospitality? What are some synonyms that you think of?
Synonyms for hospitality.
Yeah, just to kind of paint the picture of what kind of life, what do you mean by living this lifestyle? So, for example, I can think of one, warmth.
Yeah, I'm not. I wouldn't say that I'm much of a thesaurus. However, you know, not to be cute, but there's a certain approach that we take specifically with Duav, and we see it as a mission statement to provide an experience that you know that our guests. You know, basically we try and take them away from what their life is and their problems, their issues or whatever might be bothering them, bring them into our world just for a couple hours to show them what the Duav experience is and what Chris Coombs as a chef stands for. And I think that is something that, you know, we live in a high pressure society these days, and ultimately to be able to just take a couple hours out of your day and completely relax and just be in the environment of flavors and textures and, you know, experience that with some beautiful wine that really enhances the experience. I think that's really what we specialize in doing. But as far as, you know, putting words down, you know, a lot of people say, oh, it's like, you know, going to your grandmother's house or here or there. And that's really not how I look at it, because the experience at each of my restaurants varies. We do a spectrum of different things well at Boston Urban Hospitality, and the experience is so different at each restaurant, okay, that to base, a mission statement for hospitality in just one specific way would be, it'd be very vague to the three concepts, because they're three very, very different experiences depending on, what the concept, what the neighborhood is, who's coming, and what their expectations are. But the one thing that remains consistent is that we consistently try to exceed guest expectations at each location for what the location is.
And it sounds like whatever the concept is, whatever restaurant your guests are at, what you do really well is provide an opportunity for these guests to detach themselves from their everyday life and kind of get away from it all and just relax. Does that sound accurate?
That's the goal. That's the goal.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us. The next question I have for you, Chef Coombs, is what was your career challenge? What is the largest career challenge you've experienced?
Okay, so, I hope that my largest career challenge still hasn't arrived yet, because I really live for the challenge, and there's been so many, but ultimately there's a lot of really, really talented chefs in this world, but there's not necessarily a lot of really talented chefs who are also very talented businessmen. And the food is, the food is one thing. Learning how to build a business plan and download everything that's in your head. Originally with Duoc, it was an 85-page business plan. And I didn't go to school for finance or anything like that. So putting that together, soup to nuts, and then going to a bank and getting financing to build my dream restaurant, I think was my biggest success challenge. Putting together the business plan for Duav, which is effectively a fine dining restaurant, I was doing that in 2008 in the middle of a recession. There was no private money. There were no investors. Mm-hmm. No one was lending. No one was leasing. The equity markets were all locked up, and I had very, very little cash of my own to speak of. But I had a dream and a passion, and I knew exactly what it was that I wanted to, what I wanted to do and where I wanted to do it. And to put all that together and to have the dream flourish and become profitable and make people happy, ultimately that was the greatest challenge at the greatest time. Now, don't get me wrong. It's not like putting together the business plan, the dream for Boston Chops was any easier.
Yeah.
But just the timing of when we opened Duav was insanity. I mean, when we were building the restaurant, it was one of the lowest times in the recession. And there were days I looked in the mirror and I was like, well, I was like, the good news is, I'm 25 years old right now. And if I lose it all, I'll be in bankruptcy for 7 years and I'll try it all again at 32.
And you have to be able to take that risk.
And that was the reality at the time. I was like, I'm going to lose over $1 million on this thing just because of bad timing in the economy. So, as I'm watching these giants close, like, Aujourd'hui and Great Bay and Icarus and all these fancy places, it stared me in the face. And then, we opened strong, we pushed through it, and we're still here today standing. So the
challenge you speak of kind of sounds like a challenge that many people in this industry face, and they might be a skilled chef, but they have to have that business mentality too. And it sounds like the way you overcame this challenge was being really, really thoughtful in the way you presented your business plan. You said over 80 pages. So you put a lot of thought into it. You worked out every detail, and you really prepared well for it. Is that kind of what you would say is the way to overcome a challenge like that?
Yes, but here's the thing. I mean, you can know how to build a business plan and have absolutely no clue how to actually execute it and make money. And ultimately, when you're dealing with, bankers or investors or whoever that is, it's a very, very different world from the chef world. And I think there's a huge disconnect with, culinary schools and things like that. No one teaches you how to do this. You just have to go and do it yourself and learn. Now, granted, you can hire consultants or lawyers or whatever, but you're not really learning until you go and do it and build it yourself. And that was honestly the most rewarding part for me is, a lot of people say to my business partner, Brian Pacini, I like, who are your investors? Who do you have? and we don't have any. And that's a really rewarding thing to say, is that we've built this empire, just he and I, you know, with a couple letters of credit, a few bucks, and going to banks and getting some, you know, preferred lending.
An incredible, you know, to know that you did this on your own. It has to be awesome. And what I think a lot of, what makes a lot of restaurateurs is that, you know, ability to take the chance like you did and to take the risk and say, you know what, it's only going to happen if I start. And that's the first step, is just starting. And that's one lesson we can take away from this, is you just, it won't happen just dreaming about it. You have to pull the trigger, and you might fail, but it's not a failure. It's a lesson learned, and you'll do it better the next time around.
Yeah, Eric, honestly, like, and many people are like, hey, how is it possible that you built this up with no investors? And honestly, a lot of it wasn't my fault, but no one was lending money in 2008, 2009. So I ended up with an SBA loan.
Oh, man. Well, hey.
You know, I mean, and that was, and if you, you know, I don't, you know, for those who deal with banking and lending, if you haven't dealt with the SBA, it is, I mean, they make you absolutely jump through hoops, but they made my dream happen, because ultimately, you know, I didn't have money. I just knew that I could create great jobs for people and run a profitable business. I had a dream, and I went for it, and it worked out.
And those dreams won't happen unless you just, you know, dive in and tackle it head on and start. So that's a very valuable lesson. Thank you, Chef Coombs, for sharing that with us. I like to call this next part of the show, for now, we're going to be calling it Knowledge Bombs. I can't really think of any other better way to describe it, but basically it's just your way to drop some quick knowledge on us and make us a little bit more successful through collaborating and sharing what has helped make you successful. So the first question I have for you is about employee retention. It's arguably the most difficult challenge for many restaurateurs and restaurant professionals. What advice do you have for us to first find these good people and then to keep them as valuable employees?
Well, finding these people is certainly the most challenging part, and I feel blessed at this point that many of these wonderful people find me, and I'm you know, lucky enough to have a team that recognizes talent and puts them in the proper place to succeed in the long term. You know, there's a undersupplied workforce currently in the Boston area, and that poses many challenges for many restaurateurs who may just be getting started or just beginning to build their brand. And ultimately, you know, sometimes you just need a body to stand on the line. And I feel like that that talent pool is one that still needs a lot of training currently. And many chefs, you know, just have the revolving door of, geez, if I can get 6 months out of this guy or girl, you know, that'll be great because it's enough people to just staff my restaurant in the interim.
Yeah.
I take a very, very, very different approach. When I sit down people and I hire them, typically, you know, for a management hire, I require a minimum commitment of 2 to 3 years. And if they can't give that to me, I have absolutely no interest in, you know, investing my time and energy and knowledge in training them to become better. And even with cooks and service staff and dishwashers, I always require a minimum commitment. If you can't dedicate enough time for me to make my mark on you, then I really don't have much interest in having you as a team member. So typically I won't do business with anyone for less than a year.
Okay. You mentioned that good people find you. What advice do you have for helping, you know, like, what is it that you do that makes people want to find you?
Well, I think that one of the amazing things about the era that we live in is we are in a social media era.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, if you're a young cook, or even if you're not a young cook, say you're a sous chef or a chef de cuisine, and you follow, you know, at Chef Chris Coombs on either Instagram or Twitter, you're able to get a snapshot into our world every day. You know, I'm always putting pictures of our newest creations on the internet or special dinners that we do. You know, so I think that cooks in particular are able to connect with the cuisine through social media. You know, so if you see 15 pictures of Chris Coombs' food on Instagram, you're like, you know, this is really food that I'd like to make.
Yeah.
you might go and apply to work at Duwab just based off of what you've seen of my social media.
Yeah, and I will
and,
say...
And it's such... Sorry. It's an amazing tool because yeah. even 5 years ago, you know, you'd put a posting on Craigslist or BostonChefs.com and things like that, and I'd spend paragraphs trying to explain what the restaurant is, and then people would come into the restaurant, stage blind, not really, you know, maybe some of them had eaten in the dining room or had the experience, but to already have an idea of what the product is before they step in the door, one, it's an advantage to the applicant because they either feel comfortable attempting to produce that type of cuisine or they do not. Mm-hmm. So the whole social element of understanding what product comes from where and if they – for me, it's all about a feel. It's about a passion. Like, are you passionate about this style of food? Because mm-hmm. there's a lot of very different styles of cuisine out there. And, you know, some people are passionate about perfect pizza and sandwiches, or some people are passionate about pasta. And, you know, some people are passionate about pork and charcuterie. Or, you know, there's just a lot of different style restaurants yeah. out there right now. And I think that through social media, I'm really able to paint a clear picture of the brand and the restaurants individually. And that sort of allows people a view from afar. So maybe I'm, you know, a cook at, you know, Le Spallier, and I'm, you know, I've worked there for a couple of years and I really enjoy it, but I'm looking for something new and different. And, you know, I see some beautiful food that Duwab's putting out. That might encourage that to be my next step. Whereas when I was a young cook, the only way you knew the food that chefs were doing in their restaurant was to eat there or to get their cookbooks. Mm-hmm. You know? So now it's like if I'm wondering what, you know, Chris Constantino is doing on his menu tonight in San Francisco at Encanto, all I have to do is get on Instagram, check out his photos, and it shows the exact food that he's doing. And I think that that's such a cool mm-hmm. thing. And I think the knowledge share that's out there is so amazing as well.
Absolutely. There's really just so much potential to learn today from to kind of treat these people that are on social media as unofficial mentors just by following in their lead and learning from what they're doing. And I'd like to compliment you on the way you do present yourself on social media, just your Facebook account alone. Like, you really you bring people into your life and show them, you know, like the recent photos you had of you just like foraging. Like, you can tell. Like, I've never met you before seeing those pictures, and I already had a sense of the kind of person you were, and I could, you know, I felt like, you know, I could respect this person because they're truly passionate about what they're doing, and that's how you attract those good employees. So that's great right. advice. Thank you for sharing that with us, Chef.
My pleasure.
The next question I have for you is, what's one resource you use, whether it's a book, website, magazine, or a podcast, that you would recommend to our listeners as a valuable learning source?
So perhaps I'm a bit old school, but I still lean toward books. And the reason that I say books are a very valuable asset is they kept me company young in my career. Oftentimes when I moved to places where, you know, I didn't have friends or family or mm-hmm. things like that. But I interpret so much more when I read a book and information is presented to me that way. And then I can formulate my own learning process in my head. As opposed to someone spoon-feeding it to me through a television show or a podcast or things like that. I you know, in my house, I have a little bit over 1,000. I haven't counted recently, but a little bit over 1,000 cookbooks.
Oh, wow.
And I believe I've read most of them. I think I've got about 35 on the to-read list, though, because I buy faster than I can read. But
it's not like you're an old man, so that's pretty impressive to have a collection.
Yeah,
like
I mean,
that.
But my life for many years was, you know, wake up very early in the morning, you know, 9 o'clock, 8 o'clock, head into work, and work all the way through midnight, 1 o'clock, and then come home, read cookbooks, you know, rinse and repeat.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I think that, you know, especially when you're in a fine dining restaurant, what is going to set you apart from everyone else working in that kitchen? When I was at the Inn of Little Washington, there were 38 cooks in the kitchen there, 38. And one of the things that I said to myself every day is, how am I possibly going to learn at a faster rate than the cooks around me to be better than they are?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a really important question to ask yourself at every level. I ask myself that question every day now. How do I become the best chef in Boston? How do I push myself to continue to try and make the best food possible every day and to grow the empire? And the answer for that, for me, has been it's about reinforcing the learning, okay? Mm-hmm. If you have, even if you don't have 38 cooks in the kitchen, say there's five, you're all basically doing the same food and working the same stations and learning the same things from the cooks that are there. The only way to step beyond what is happening in your everyday workforce is to reinforce the learning at home. And I've always done that with books. Granted, there's a lot of great things out there. Many of my cooks love to read Lucky Peach and things like that. And those are all fun and great, and there's some great information in there. But especially with some of these older cookbooks that are less picture books and more about information and science, and you know, many nights Harold McGee on Food and Cooking kept me company, and you know, LaRousse and some of these really classic, you know, books. You know, I'd hear about a new sauce or something that was new to me or a new preparation, and then I'd go and read five or six different books to reinforce the learning and find out where it came from, find out where the variations mm-hmm. were. And I think that, you know, a lot of cooking is about building flavor memories and mm-hmm. building a depth of knowledge that can ultimately, when it comes to creating food, you know, you create food based on, you know, past experiences of flavor memories, you know, and how okay. do you build those memories and how do you build that variation? And I think that it really comes back to reinforced learning.
Wow. That's really impressive. I mean, just 1,000 books, it's staggering. Out of these 1,000 books, is there one lesson from one of these books that really stands out to you that you would like to share with our guests or our listeners?
Look, I mean, for me, there's many treasures to be unlocked in each book that I have. There really are. But, you know, so for me, books have always been a steering committee as well. And one of the reasons that I had always dreamt to go work at the Inn at Little Washington years ago was, for many years, the Inn at Little Washington cookbook was my favorite book. And it was a book that was so far ahead of its time. I mean, the books that I was reading in high school back in the late 90s, I mean, you're talking about a time before everyone had a cookbook. So there were the Charlie Trotter book. I mean, I remember the meat and game, vegetable, seafood, dessert books that came out in the late 90s. You had Alain Ducasse had a couple books out. And Patrick O'Connell's book came out, and it blew me away. You know, that, and there was another book from, actually, you know what? I think I can actually answer this question without being so vague. There was a book that came out, I'm trying to remember the year. All right, so there was an old-time chef. I don't think he has any restaurants anymore, but there's an old-time chef by the name of Gray Coons. Are you familiar with Gray Coons? K-U-N-D. Like the guy who came up with the Coon spoon that everyone cooks with nowadays?
I can't say I am familiar, but enlighten me.
Okay, so he had a book that came out, I think it was like 2000 or 2001. And the name of the book was Elements of Taste. That book, okay, he talks about flavors that push, flavors that pull, flavors that punctuate.
Mm-hmm.
That book, okay, might be the clearest interpretation of how to figure out how food works.
Okay.
And that book was a book that I referenced numerous times to understand how flavors work together through different taste platforms. And like I just remember the way the book was set up. Like, it's still a guide about how I think about food today. So there was like, there were tastes that push, which is like salty and sweet or picante, and then tastes that pull, which is like tangy, herbal, funky, mushroomy, like allium bulby. And then, like, there's, like, your punctuation, which is, like, bitterness and acid. And it sort of, like, rounds out the science behind food composition. So that book, for me, was groundbreaking for me, you know, like, 12 years ago, because it just showed me how to think about why food works together and how you can build food to be in balance. And I think that was a big thing that Ming Tsai pushed a lot in in his kitchen was, you know, balance in food.
You're just a depth of knowledge. And I guess this is what I get when I ask a guy who's read over 1,000 books, which is his favorite book. But, wow, you take the gold for being the most elaborate answer for this question. That was a whole list of great things. Thank you for sharing all that. I'll try to find all those books and provide links for anybody who wants to check out on and learn more about these books in the show notes. So just go there. I hate to cut you off. I'm sure you could tell me about so much more in this topic, but we got to continue to the next question.
Sure.
Which is one restaurant trend which has really caught your attention that you look to take advantage of?
I think that the new San Pellegrino list came out yesterday, and Noma is back at the top. And I think that the most exciting trend that comes out of that kitchen is the collection and gathering of the local wild ingredients. And I think what's so exciting for me about that is that it's not something that everyone can do. It actually forages. Is very, very dangerous unless you are well-educated on the topic. And what makes that such an exciting trend is that it encourages chefs who are excited about that trend to find out about the earth and find out about wild products and try and learn and teach themselves. But the best part of it is it's a trend that not everyone's going to be able to execute.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, look, man, I can tell you, hey, my restaurant's farm to table.
Yeah.
And my sister, who has no knowledge of food whatsoever, could very easily open a restaurant and have no clue what she's doing, call a bunch of local farmers, get their product, and ultimately she would then own and operate a farm-to-table restaurant.
Absolutely.
But, that's I have like a fundamental issue with that whole movement, because I think that is the only responsible way to source. Is to support your local economy and support local farmers and things like that. Now, when you take a trend like the Noma trend, that's just not something everyone out there could do.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it a little bit more complex, and granted, you can work with a lot of local great foragers, but there's only so many people who go out there and forage, and ultimately there's not enough supply, so you have to learn how to do it yourself.
And it takes a certain level of commitment that goes further, too, which you can't get anywhere, which is really impressive and kind of sets that
standard
to it.
This time of year in particular, the fall harvest is a lot more abundant in New England in particular than the spring harvest, and there is a certain level of dedication. For example, I had worked the previous 14 days in a row, and Sunday I knew I had to be in at 5 o'clock. Now, my best foraging locations are about 2.5 hours west of Boston out in the Berkshires. And I can obviously say where that is, because if you want to go walk around the mountains for, 6 hours and try and find where stuff grows, be my guest. So that's where I was. That's where I was on Sunday, because I was out particularly for ramps, and they only grow in Appalachia. So all the way up the East Coast. It's not something that you like will not find ramps in eastern Massachusetts. It's just not possible. I woke up extra early, drove 2.5 hours out there, didn't have any idea of how muddy it would be, but that's fine. So one of my spots had washed away, but the dedication to go out there, and I hiked for effectively about 3 hours and then got downpoured on while I was just under 2 miles into the woods. And, and came back, got to the restaurant by 5 o'clock. At Duave, and then fed 125 people that night. My gatherings out there will only last us 3 or 4 days tops.
Oh, wow.
Do
you find that to be a challenge to kind of hold to this foraging niche? And then
I love it, and it keeps me connected with Earth, and just sometimes it's really important as a chef to not get disconnected from your product. I think that it's, there's a lot of cooks who've cooked with ramps or wild mushrooms, but I think a very, very small percentage has ever seen it grow in its natural environment. And I think that gives you a deeper appreciation for the product itself. I often tell the cooks, if you had to hike, 2 miles up a mountain to get a beautiful patch of morel mushrooms, you'd certainly think twice before you ever burnt those mushrooms when they're in the pan. It just gives you, it gives you a different connection to the food.
Also, the connection your guests are getting too, to know that so much, you know, passion went into the meal that they're about to consume, just has to be kind of just for them to connect on that level. I mean, I can only imagine. I've never been able to experience it. Oh yeah, absolutely. You're just giving some amazing, elaborate answers, and I don't want to cut you off short on anything. But we're approaching the 50-minute mark right now, and I still got a couple more answers to go. So thank you for just these great answers. But the next one I have for you is whether your role is in front of house or in back of house or in the office or maybe all of the above. Is there one product or service that is you know, coming out? Or there's products and services that are coming out every day. Is there one that you're using at your restaurant that you're seeing like a return on investment that you'd like to give, you know, an objective review to or on for our listeners?
I actually thought of this question prior when you sent me the list, and I don't have anything for that. We've had the same system set up in the restaurant since we opened. We use the same back office and front office operations system in all three restaurants, and it does the trick, but it's not any more mind-blowing than any of the other operating systems.
Is there maybe just a way that you operate that has worked really well, that improves communication, just like a suggestion you might have to kind of maximize efficiency and communication at your restaurant?
Sure. I mean, one of my mission statements, which was downloaded from Patrick O'Connell many years ago, was that if there is no system in place, then there is no system.
Mm-hmm.
And we're big on systems of efficiency in all three restaurants, but particularly at Duave, and just making sure that all those systems overlap to ensure the most efficient guest experience possible.
Absolutely. And systems truly are so important when it comes down to consistency, to you constantly have new people coming in and everybody has to be on the same system, or there's just traffic jams in the kitchen or in the front of the house. So people just start running into each other. So that's why systems are so important when it comes to efficiency. So that's great advice. The next question I have for you, Chef, is what is the best business advice you have for someone who's just getting started in this industry?
In the restaurant business, look, you know, you're either willing to dedicate your entire life to this business or you're not. You need to have very understanding friends and family, because if you don't, you're more than likely to lose them all. And there are a lot easier ways to make money than the restaurant business. So if you don't love it, don't even try.
Yeah, this isn't an industry to get into if you're looking to make money. It's an industry that you can't get away from because you can imagine doing anything else.
I don't know the percentages of people who make quote unquote money in this business, and I don't know what the definition of making money is, or what that level is, because it differs for a lot of people. You know, a lot of people are happy making $30,000 a year. Then there's people who are miserable making $250,000 a year. But ultimately, if financial goals are your sole reason for going into this business, it's probably not the best idea.
That's so great advice. Thank you for sharing that. Make sure your reasons for getting into this industry are appropriate, because you could get disappointed really fast. The last question I have for you, Chef Coombs, is what is one question you think should have been added to this interview that you wish I did ask, or maybe you think would be a good addition to the show? And what's the answer to that question?
You know, I think that this has been a pretty conclusive experience. And I think for, you know, people who are perhaps questioning, it seems like a lot of what we've done today has been geared toward perhaps people who are considering getting into the business, or have been intrigued by the allure, perhaps through what they see on television. And I think to really tie together everything that we've spoken about today is to touch upon what we think, or what I think, about food television and how that differs from everyday life and the kitchen. Because I think a lot of people are now drawn to this business through what they see on Food Network.
Yeah, and the glamour that really is kind of, it's television, really. It's not reality.
Right. It isn't. And honestly, I think there's a lot of young people. Look, Food Network and food television is the best slash worst thing to ever happen to this business. You know, when I first went to school, it was, you know, basically the Emeril Lagasse, Ming Tsai, Iron Chef era. There just wasn't a lot of, it wasn't hip and cool to be a chef yet. It wasn't the coolest thing on television, you know. And I just saw an advertisement for a new television show on MTV that's a reality cooking show. And I said to myself, wow, food has really made it. Now that MTV is going to bastardize my profession. I think we may have peaked. That might be it. We might be in decline now.
Yeah.
But to answer my own question, which is, what are the differences? And I want to relate to people that the everyday life of cooking, of being a chef, of serving, is 180 degrees of separation from what you see on television. Mm-hmm. Television's highly edited, sometimes in a negative light, sometimes in a positive light. But, you know, for people who really think they have a genuine interest in this business, go work in a restaurant. It's not all glitz and glamour. Yes, there can be very, very rewarding parts, but don't think that what you see on Top Chef or Food Network is the way that this life is. You know, the reality of this business is you work nights, you work weekends, you work when everyone else is out having fun, you work holidays, and generally you work when anything of interest is going on. And your life, you know, really occurs between, you know, midnight and 10 in the morning. That's mm-hmm. your life. Everyone else's life is work 9 to 5 and then enjoy the rest of the time.
Yeah, and you touched on it a little bit about, like, why I didn't mean to cut you off there. Do you want to finish your thought?
No, please.
Yeah, you were just saying, you know, I created this podcast to kind of tap into the people like you who are truly passionate about it and who have all that knowledge that they can share, and it's what I'm trying to do is really just try to be motivational and inspirational and to take these lessons and these life lessons and these life stories and to kind of use them to inspire others and to educate others and to make them know that, you know, we don't do this for the money. We do this because we're passionate about it. And hopefully through listening to these stories, those individuals who are thinking about either getting into it or just need a kind of a little boost to keep them going, kind of get inspired. And your stories and everyone else's stories are hopefully doing that for everyone that is listening in. So thank you so much for all of the stories and the wisdom and the motivation and inspiration. That's what we're here for. And also to collaborate and to share and to help become, you know, better and more masterful of our professions. So thank you. It's great.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So let's wrap it up. What is or who is a restaurant professional you admire and believe would be a great addition to the show?
My number one admirer slash mentor, he is a friend of mine as well, is actually Danielle Ballou of the Dynex Group in New York. And I've always found his feedback to be super insightful. I mean, every time I see him or even if it's seeing him on TV or things like that, there's always the guy is just a wealth of knowledge, and he is the prime example in America of a chef success story and a guy who built himself up from nothing and now operates an empire.
I am hopefully I can get you on the show. Hopefully you're listening, and if you can help me connect with them, I would be very appreciative to kind of continue the sharing and inspiration and motivation. So now this is your opportunity to give yourself a plug, give your restaurant a plug, maybe give a note to somebody who's out there listening in who might be considering coming to work for you. How can we connect?
Sure. So the best way to reach me is on social media, at Chef Chris Coombs. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram as well, or even on Facebook. Most of the direct messaging is enabled on those social media platforms, and I'll be happy to engage you on social media first. Also, if you would like to experience our restaurants, Duwav is located in the historic Back Bay on the corners of Commonwealth Avenue and Massachusetts Avenue, and that is my fine dining French concept married with the splendor of new American ingredients. In addition to that, I own Boston Chops, which is in the South End on Washington Street across from the Cathedral. And that is at 1375 Washington Street. Boston Chops is a modern interpretation of an American steakhouse, which takes a responsible approach to using all the wonderful parts of the steer. So we take a very balanced approach to the utilization of the steer. And then my original restaurant, which is entering year nine, is down in Dorchester in Savin Hill, and that's D-Bar, and that is our urban bistro brasserie that also seamlessly transforms into a nightclub three nights a week.
Awesome.
And again, you can reach out to me through Twitter with any other follow-up questions at Chef Chris Coombs.
Great. There you have it, guys. If you're somebody who is interested in maybe, chasing a profession that incorporates a lot of foraging and goes after that kind of niche and that is interesting to you, I would highly suggest tapping into this resource that is Chef Coombs. He would be an incredible person to work for and learn from. So thank you so much. We all have learned so much already, and it was a pleasure, an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Your answers were extremely detailed and to the point, and I had a blast talking to you.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure to be on the show.
Oh, it was my pleasure. We'll keep in touch.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Take care.
I don't know about you guys, but I had a blast with this episode. Chris just, wow. Almost 1,000 books, cookbooks read by the age of 30. I mean, that just blew me away personally. And it's to think that somebody has that much commitment to their job. And it's really, like you said, it's not his job, it's his passion. And that's really what it takes to be successful. And you need to keep that in mind if you are considering this profession as your career. Are you ready to take that commitment? Are you ready to be fully engaged in, consumed in this, what people call a career, but it's really a lifestyle. And that's what you have to accept. Some of the things that really stood out to me in this episode, I'll quote him. This was in regards to his opening the first location and getting the financing. But he said, I'm only 25 years old, and if I lose it all, I'll be bankrupt. And in 7 years, I'll try all over again. And I really took that away. In this industry, we have to take chance, and that's part of it. And if you aren't willing and ready to accept the risk, then maybe this isn't the right industry for you, but you'll never know unless you try. And there's a famous, I think it's a monk saying, I think that's where I heard it, but maybe it's Japanese, I'm not sure, wherever it came from, when's the best time to plant a tree? 20 years ago, but the next best time is right now. And if you have any question, and if you're 100% convinced that this isn't just a job for you, but it's your passion, you got to start right now. And it starts with making connections and establishing relationships and getting those mentors. There's always something you can be doing and reaching out and connecting with people to point you in the right direction. But the trick is to start. And I really took that away from this interview today. Chris kind of really delved into that and explained, you have to have a plan. You need to be able to implement your plan and follow through with it. But most importantly, you have to start. Also, what really stood out to me, which has really been slowly resonating and growing in resonation with me, is I'll quote him again, the only responsible way to source is from local farms. And it's not just, being like earthy and, woo-woo and all, gushy-mushy and support your local farmer. But, at the end of the day, that's where we've grown so far outside of our communities, and we need to turn back around and focus in our communities. And one of the best ways to do that and to show that enlightened hospitality is by supporting our communities, by sourcing from our community and putting that money back into the community. And this is so important, and we need to start to rebuild our middle class, and this is just one way we can do it. It's a big picture we have to think about, and I really do believe that it's going to be the food and beverage industry, the hospitality industry, that kind of creates the spark in society and kind of reminds people how far away we've gotten from our own communities, which is hopefully one of the messages I can send to you in this podcast. Just do the research. I don't need to tell you. The information's out there. It's scary where we are today. We need to do something about it. So thanks for bringing that up today, Chris. You were amazing. I can't wait for the next interview. There's always something new and neat to be learned. But until then, don't be afraid to connect with me on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Google+. I'm out there. I'm easy to connect with. Tell me who you want to hear from. I'm here to serve you. I love getting new ideas. That's it for tonight. I'll stop rambling. We're going on 1 hour, 5 minutes. Way to break the record, Chris. You shattered that bitch. All right, guys. Until next time, peace.